From the Sky News Centre at 6, the economy's dominated today's election campaigning. As figures show, it grew only slightly in the first 3 months of this year. David Cameron believes a Conservative government could put it right, while the PM says his rivals would put the recovery at risk. The Lib Dem leader, Nick Clegg, says they're both wrong.
Gordon Brown says people can't take a chance on real change. People shouldn't take a risk on real change. That he somehow is the guarantor of stability. This, a man who's presided over the worst economic recession in living memory.
Six members of a family have been convicted over the murder of a man whose headless body was found in the lake in Bedfordshire last year. Michael Gilbert was kept as a slave and tortured for his benefit money. Ofsted's chief inspector says she's pleased their actions in the Sharon Shoesmith case have been vindicated by the High Court. A judge has ruled the former head of children's services at Haringey Council in North London was lawfully sacked over the baby Peter case. Sharon Shoesmith had claimed her dismissal was politically motivated, but the children's secretary Ed Ball says the judge was right to reject that.
There were also allegations that I wanted a scapegoat, I just jumped straight in. In fact, he says, I acted in a proper and fair way, and there was a balance to be struck here, but I needed to make sure children were safe.
More than 2,000 holidaymakers rescued by a brand new cruise ship in Spain are finally back in Britain. The passengers who were caught out abroad by the ash cloud crisis docked in Southampton after a 30-hour trip aboard a luxury liner. Union leaders have called off a planned strike by AA patrol workers over the May bank holiday weekend. It's to allow for more time for talks in a pensions dispute. And can the whiff of peppermint help boost pupils' results? A primary school in Liverpool is taking part in an experiment to see if smells and sounds can help youngsters' concentration skills and their ability to remember information. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time, and the latest on Bristol City Council's sell-off of the farm in Portishead we've owned for about 400 years. That's Court Farm. The auction is on May the 10th, but will it be kept as a local amenity for people to use as a unique riding centre, or just sold off with our elected councillors having no chance to take part in the decision whether to sell it or not? Is this just another example of Cabinet members and unelected council officers making decisions which should really be made democratically? And drugs policy, one of the most important topics amongst parents and teachers, but it hasn't featured at all so far in the election, so far as I've seen. We talked to legal adviser Steve Barker about what he thinks should be done and why none of the three main parties are addressing it. And we take a look later at the controversial topic of mind control. Is it possible to psychologically traumatise people so much that they will simply do what they're told? Does this dangerous form of abuse really exist? And if so, who's using it? Why? And how are they covering up? But before all that, Martin Summers joins me to discuss the latest LEAP 2020 report. Martin, maybe you could just explain, what is LEAP 2020?
It's a think tank. I think it's based in Paris, and they're basically economic and political forecasters. Most of the stuff they do, you have to subscribe to get. So, you know, companies and governments and people who are interested buy reports from them. But they issue quarterly reports about the general situation in the world economy, which are available to everybody. Every quarter they produce a report. And they've tended to be, the reason I read their stuff is because they've tended to be absolutely right and spot on in all of their predictions.
Because we're hearing all the time that, oh, nobody predicted this economic crisis.
Well, I mean, nobody inside the golden circle of those in government and in the city predicted it, but that doesn't mean it wasn't predicted. Lots of people predicted it.
Well, this is one of the reasons I like having you on here, because you're there on YouTube, whatever it is, 2.5 years ago, actually talking about a lot of the stuff that's happening today. One of the quotes from that LEAP 2020 report is, who will be or able to want to help the United Kingdom after the 6th of May, when its political chaos will inevitably espouse the advanced meltdown of all its budget, economic and financial parameters? Now, I imagine quite a lot of people in the city will be saying this is just scaremongering.
Well, they may say that if they wish. They've been right about everything so far. I think what's happened in general is that people have lulled themselves into a false sense of security about the economy. That obviously the message coming from the top is don't panic, it's all going to be all right, and that's what people want to hear, and so therefore that's what they believe. But if you actually look at the stats, the world economy is on the ropes, really. I mean, there's been a bit of a boost in growth in China and India, but don't forget the governments of the world have been chucking money at this like there was no tomorrow, and the growth figures are very disappointing. If you think that in actual fact the governments of the world have been printing money like mad for 2 years, and that's all they can get is a couple of percentage points on growth, that's pretty scary.
So how do Leap 2020 manage to do this? Because they're just giving out information for free on the internet, are they?
No, they use the quarterly bulletins as a kind of loss leader, if you like, for buying the other stuff. Yeah. I mean, these quarterly bulletins that don't go into a great deal of detail, they're only a couple of pages long usually, they're always very informative, but what they're basically doing is directing people to their pay-per-view stuff, if you like, you know, the real meaty stuff you've got to pay for.
So some of the professional financial analysts will be paying the money and actually getting more information from them.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are high-powered, and that's why they're able to sell their expertise. I think what's interesting about their perspective on things is it's very much a perspective from Paris. So they see the US and Britain in particular as being, you know, basically the most overextended of all the countries.
So is that true?
I think it is true, yeah. I mean, one of the things they say in this report is that a lot of the stuff about the Greek crisis has been rather manufactured in order to draw, to get people's attention away from the fact that the United States is actually the real... I mean, they are the biggest players in the world economy, and they're the ones who've got the most problems, the biggest budget deficit, the biggest sort of trade deficit, and so on. And, of course, there's a real danger that the US economy is just going to implode, and that, of course, will not be good news. It'll be horrible.
So, website, is it? Do you know the Leap 2020 website, if people are interested in checking
that out?
Yeah,
I mean, if you just put it into a search engine, it's LEAP 2020, and what it means is something long-range forecasting or something in French. And 2020 is where, you know, that's the horizon within which they forecast, if you like.
Okay, we've also got a story from the IMF this week. The IMF are talking about interesting new bank tax plans. In fact, not one, but two. And this is something you've been calling for quite a while on here, and many other people have. Something called the Robin Hood tax, but they're going one step further.
Yeah, well, the Robin Hood tax is the Tobin tax, and these two new taxes aren't, in fact, Tobin. Tobin taxes are taxes on financial transactions. These are taxes on basically on profits and turnover. And I think what most commentators were surprised about was that the IMF, you know, which is actually not a terribly radical institution, has decided not just to suggest one tax increase on the banks, but two separate ones. Gordon Brown has leaped on this and said that this is the kind of thing he's been pushing for years, and the IMF are backing him up. There may be some truth in that. I think he does have influence at the top levels of the IMF, and these kind of things are the sort of thing he has been suggesting. And of course, in the leadership debates, he's trying. I mean, he's got the third one coming up next week. He is going to try and play the, you know, I am the man that knows what's going on in the economy card. And he does, in many ways, know what's going on. But of course, he is actually responsible for a lot of the mess. It's all a little bit too late.
Okay. Now, drug policy, which is at the heart of many people's concerns in the most deprived areas of Bristol, hasn't been featuring very much in the election campaign so far. So I'm joined on the line from East Anglia, I hope, anyway, now by one of the management committee of the Legalised Cannabis Alliance, Steve Barker. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Steve, what is the Legalised Cannabis Alliance?
Well, it started as a political party in 1999. And it stood about 50 candidates in local and national elections, picked up around about 40,000 votes over about an eight-year period. I think that we started it because when we spoke to politicians or police people or civil servants, they said, oh, well, yes, we support legalization of cannabis, or some of them said that, but there's no votes in it. Well, we proved that there actually are votes in it. We deregistered as a political party for a number of reasons. One was that the involvement of continuing to be a political party and having to put in financial returns and so on is getting increasingly complicated. Nobody really wanted to keep doing that. And also, certain people hadn't supported us because they don't support political parties. So we're now more of a group that's involved in pressuring or lobbying or information and so on.
Now, what people will first of all say is that actually cannabis can be very psychologically damaging. So what are you doing trying to legalise it?
What are we doing trying to legalise it? Well, there's 12 states in America that don't think it's damaging. They think that it's a very powerful medicine, which is what we think. A majority of our members and supporters are actually medical users. And although there has been tests done with regard to pain relief as well, using cannabis, they were done near where I live in Norfolk. And in fact, cannabis is now available through the NHS as an unlicensed medicine in the form of Sativex.
So anyway, getting back to the harder drugs and those issues, what proportion of prisoners are in jail for drug-related offences?
Well, when cannabis was previously in Class B, and the peak in 1999, there was 100,000 people who were being arrested for cannabis. That's against 25,000 people who were arrested for all other drugs combined. So you can see from that that the number of people involved in cannabis is four or five times the number of people who are involved in all other drugs. This is why it's such a big issue. We think there's probably about 5 million cannabis users in the country, a large majority. And we feel that it's time for us to have our rights respected.
But what about the harder drugs, though? You know, because we often hear that many people are in jail for those.
Well, I can't speak for hard drugs because I haven't ever had any experience of them. And all I can say is that there are people who are supporters of the legalized cannabis campaign who've used cannabis to actually get off the dependence on hard drugs and the dependence on alcohol and even dependence on smoking tobacco.
So cannabis was removed recently from a Class C drug, is that right, up to a Class B?
That's right.
Why did that happen?
Well, the government doesn't really tell you why they do things in this particular case, but as you know, four or five people resigned from the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, which I believe now has no members of the pharmaceutical industry represented on it. And they obviously disagreed with the decision, which went against their legal advice. There was a woman called Deborah Bell who ran a sort of campaign to get it put back into Class B. It's really hard to know why. I mean, she was a failed writer, and I think she wanted to sort of flag up her writing career. Her husband was a prosecution barrister, and I think he, like a lot of other people in the legal profession, were feeling the pinch when they couldn't. The number of cannabis cases went down.
What's the actual difference when a drug is up in Class B? Does that mean that there's more arrests made, or I would imagine so?
Well, in actual fact, when they put cannabis into Class C initially in 2004, I think they upped the penalties for possession. No, they upped the penalties for supply and cultivation, or what they call production, of Class C drugs to what they are in Class B drugs. So, a solicitor who deals with a lot of cannabis cases explained to me it didn't really make that much difference. From that point of view, when it came to supply and cultivation, that's the main the thing. I mean, as far as we're concerned, it doesn't really matter if it's in Class A, Class B, Z, or whatever class it's in. What happens is the loss of privacy and the loss of sort of rights that anybody has. I mean, if people weren't arrested and weren't charged with using cannabis, then obviously it wouldn't really matter what class it was in.
So you're obviously supporting decriminalisation of cannabis. Surely we can't have people just buying it in Tesco's, can we?
Well, I mean, there's in Holland, it's available. There was recently a vote in Haarlem, which is an area where there's a lot of cannabis cafes, about amongst the people, run by a newspaper, and 95% of the people who replied wanted those cafes to stay open.
Now, what do you think is the relation between the harder drugs and the cannabis? Because I know you do know a fair bit about the hard drugs too. Do you think there's any relation between particular dealers, and the way that these drugs are trafficked, or is it the cannabis, which is considered to be a softer drug? Is it a different sort of setup, or are all the same people trafficking it?
Well, the main difference is that you can legally buy. Seeds which will cultivate, which you can grow yourself and cultivate your own cannabis, whereas I don't think it's really possible to cultivate other drugs or hard drugs. They have to be imported, or they have to be obtained through criminal supply. And this is really the next stage of the campaign, is to make it clear that since these seeds are legally available, and people who are growing for personal use or for medical use, they shouldn't be criminalised.
So, well, why do you think that cannabis is different to the harder drugs? What do you think is it actually in the effects that they have on people that makes them?
Well, cannabis is actually being used socially for thousands of years in India, the Middle East, particularly, and in this country, in fact.
Well,
it was available in this country. Some people say it was even available in Shakespeare's time.
Well, we had opium wars hundreds of years ago, didn't we, as well? Because of opium use over in the Far East.
Well, when I first became familiar with cannabis, Afghanistan was famous for growing for supplying it, and Afghani hash was you know, a very kind of respected strain. That all seems to change now, and mainly they seem to be growing opium. So in fact, there's, you know, I don't think that the war in Afghanistan has really helped the situation.
You're asking me to comment, Tony. Yes, I think that cannabis should be legalised, in my view. I mean, all the arguments you've just given are very sensible. I think we've got to look very hard at the legalisation of harder drugs as well, and that's not because drugs are good for you. Let's be clear, taking drugs is often bad for you, but the criminal market that's been developed now is basically corrupting everything. A series of Latin American senior politicians, including Cardozo, who used to be the president of Brazil, have put forward a report recently saying, look, we've got to decriminalize drugs, because if we don't, we're going to lose control of the situation, because criminal groups are actually being massively funded through these deals that they make. And of course, the other problem is that the Western intelligence services, both in Afghanistan and Colombia, have been implicated in drug dealing, and what they do is they fund their proxy allies through this. So the AUC, Auto de Unidas Defensas de Colombia, the right wing paramilitaries who are allied with the United States, they're funded through cocaine. And in the 80s, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan were funded through opium, and the DEA and the CIA knew exactly what was going on. And we've got a real problem here.
If you wander through parts of Bristol, you know, maybe St. Paul's and Easton, it's pretty obvious where the drug dealing is going on from. It just seemed, you know, to me, to be someone who's lived around there, you know, everybody locally seems to know where these places are. Why did the police not act? Do you want to start, Steve? Do you want to start on that one? It's because it's a bit of a thorny issue, isn't it? If everybody can see where this is going on, how come the police aren't closing these places down?
Well, I mean, I just looked at some figures from the Ministry of Justice, and it was announced recently today on the radio that crime is going down. But if you look at the statistics, in fact, drug crime is the only crime that's going up. But people take drugs by their own choice. They want to take them. The vast majority of drug users, they're not, their ability to live a normal lifestyle is not actually adversely affected by the drugs they take. Unlike alcohol, where you've got serious problems with alcoholism. And so if it's a moral law. If you say to people, like, we don't want you to do that, because we don't think you should, and then you know, this is basically the problem. I mean, if you said to people, we don't want anybody to wear green clothes, or, for example, this thing where they don't want Muslim women to cover up their faces, they do that presumably by their own choice. And this is, and of course, the amount of money that the people are prepared to pay in order to take the drugs or have them available, then goes into criminal hands. When I was, I remember back in the 60s, I was proud to live in a country where heroin addiction or drug addiction was considered to be a disease. In fact, in the 30s, it was called the soldier's disease because of the number of people who'd taken heroin or other opiates during the time in the trenches and then become addicted to them. But since then, and then there, I remember there was something like 450 heroin addicts in the country. There's now a 250,000. So that shows you this total failure of the government's policy with regard to hard drugs.
So why is it that, as I said before, do you think that the police aren't just simply closing down these places where all the neighbours can see very obviously that there's drug dealing going on? Martin?
I think, Tony, as we sit here this evening, there will be thousands of people across Bristol taking drugs. Don't kid yourself, it's going on right as we speak. The police have got a series of priorities for things they need to deal with. Top of the list of priorities is personal violence, robbery, and so forth. They haven't got the time or the energy to go chasing around after everybody in the city who is taking drugs. And you talk to any senior police officer, they will tell you this. We can't be wasting our time chasing after these people. And many senior police officers understand the argument I made earlier, that if we don't, I don't say legalise so you can buy in Tesco's. As Steve just pointed out, if you're a heroin addict in Britain in the 60s, you go to the doctor and you get heroin. You don't deal, you don't steal, you don't cause any problems for anybody else. And of course the state can provide heroin to these people virtually cost free, you know, a penny a hit. The real cost of drugs is all the cost of smuggling and so on. Yeah, so you could use the opium grown in Afghanistan to treat all of our addicts and buy it off the farms at a good price and use it to treat our, but that shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't be encouraging young people to go and take heroin. We're just pointing out the reality that some people will.
So
we've got to work around that.
I'll just ask both of you, do you think that the mafia, the people that are trading this stuff around the world, are really afraid of these hard drugs being decriminalised?
I think the fundamental political problem is that the US blocks any attempt at rational policy on this. And as I pointed out earlier, that is because since the 1940s, the CIA have used hard drug dealing in particular to fund their political allies. The Hmong in Vietnam, the nationalists in China, the right-wing paramilitaries there you see in Colombia, the Mujahideen, Gulbenin Hekmatyar, who used to be our ally in the war against the Russians. We're now fighting against him. But he was given a green light by the West CIA, MI6, to deal drugs. And of course, the point is that the people who've got a green light to deal drugs are protected, like Adolfo Calero, who used to be the head of the FLN in Nicaragua. And of course, that means that the whole of the police force and the DEA are just chasing the competition to the CIA. And the whole drugs industry has corrupted the whole of our politics completely.
Yeah? Is that something you agree with, Steve? Steve?
Well, exactly. I mean, the whole nature of how the police operate, which is anybody they arrest, they for drugs, they say, well, give us any addresses and it'll be best for you. And the outcome of this is that there are some drug dealers they allow to operate in exchange for addresses, and the dealers use this to get rid of the competition. So, I mean, inadvertently, the police are actually getting involved in turf wars as to which, you know, which dealers are preferred to other dealers. I'm not blaming the police. They don't make the laws, and they have a terrible job to try and enforce them. I think now is the time that we should... And this is one of the things that I'm very keen on the LCA doing, is to talk to police officers and to politicians, hopefully, you know, as soon as we know who the government is, and say, look, you know, you're complaining about this business of legal highs, which you say should be illegal, and mushrooms and so on, and everything is just blank. And this is why people are resigning from the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, because the actual effect of these drugs isn't really being considered. It's being it's prohibition by media outrage, basically.
Okay, now, Steve, you run a legal helpline, don't you?
Yes.
Can you tell us why you decided to do that, and how you got into doing that, and what the...
Well, I got into that in 2001 when I went to a cannabis rally in Trafalgar Square, and I met some solicitors, a barrister and a lawyer, a barrister and a solicitor, and I talked to them, and I had the idea that actually... most of the people who get arrested for cannabis or charged, they it comes out of the blue, and they're otherwise law-abiding people. We had very good results from getting people using a medical defence, and by saying, you know, that actually they were using for medical reasons. Unfortunately, that was made more difficult after 2005 when a group of solicitors took their clients to the appeal court and asked to have medical necessity accepted as a defence. But I was there at the hearing, and the team of judges was asking questions like, oh, well, how much pain is equivalent to a serious injury, or how much pain would somebody suffer before they decided to end their lives? The reason is this, because defence of necessity depends on death or serious injury. However, on the second morning, a young barrister arrived from the Attorney General's office and said in so many words, the government is not going to allow medical necessity as a defence. So we really made no headway on that. The headway regarding medical use, of course, is in America, where there's now 15 states who do allow people to use cannabis for medical reasons if they have a letter from the doctor recommending it. And there are other states that are considering going in this direction. The same is largely true in Canada and parts of Australia. Possession of drugs, I think, in Portugal is now being decriminalised. And there is a system operating in Spain called cannabis clubs, which campaigners have got together, which means that you can join a social club, and there a certain allocation number of plants to each member is grown in one setup, and it's a bit like the old rifle clubs they used to have. You know, the police know who's a member, they know how much is being produced, they know where it's going, and so it's all regulated.
Now,
Steve, systems, I think, are showing better effect than what we've got.
Now, Steve, we're in the run-up to a general election, so how do the main parties shape up with their, you think, their drug policies? Including the Greens, of course.
I think the main parties, the Liberals, are the ones who have, come out basically to support prohibition. But our experience with the Liberal Party is that it varies from member to member. There are some members of the Liberal Party who are support toleration, but some are prohibitionists. So they'll have to sort out, if they get to power, I guess, what they'll do. But fundamentally, we just think that the police and the law should call off the harassment of people who are just cultivating small amount for their own use.
I'm sort of bringing the conversation back to what I was saying earlier. There's a report, a UN report on money laundering recently, which pointed out that during the financial crisis of the last 2 years, huge amounts of dirty money have been gobbled up by the banks to cover their bottom lines. So the whole financial system has become dependent on drug dealing, and that is the reality.
Sorry, Martin, can you just clarify that? How?
If you've got a load of money that you want to get rid of, or you want to launder it, then you're prepared to lend it to a bank or a hedge fund at a much, much more competitive rate of interest than the market rate.
those who borrow money from these dirty sources outcompete those who play by the rules. And what it actually has actually now happened, the Russian Secret Service are claiming that the American occupation of Afghanistan is being almost entirely funded by drugs. This is what's going on. They are basically accusing the Americans of promoting drug dealing. I mean, we get this image that we had Barbara earlier from saying, oh, well, we're there in Afghanistan to stop all these nasty things happening. Frankly, people don't know the history. The history is that the British and the Americans encouraged the growth of opium production in Afghanistan as a means of fighting the Soviets, and in actual fact, they are now using it as a means to underpin their banking system and to fight the war. Now, we have actually got a mafia takeover of our international politics. It's been going on for about 50 years, and it's coming to a head. That's why we're in such a crisis. But the drugs are at the heart of that crisis. They're not a peripheral marginal issue. And of course I agree with Steve about sensible steps to legalise cannabis, which frankly is the least harmful of all the drugs that people take, including tobacco and alcohol. There's no real logic behind the law against cannabis. It's just ridiculous. But I think the real issue is the harder drugs and the issues behind that. And that means going to the bottom of what Western intelligence services have been up to for the last 50 years.
Okay, Steve.
I'd like to add that when you're talking about total, you know, all drugs, as far as we're concerned, is that you can't change the attitude of all drugs all at once. But if cannabis was legalized, this would be a big step towards solving the problem.
Okay, Steve, and your legal helpline again. Can you just tell us what kind of help people can get from the helpline and where it is?
Well, I mean, I accept calls from people who want information about the drug situation, especially if they've been arrested, and I've got about five or six solicitors around the country who are very sympathetic and knowledgeable in dealing with these cases. So if anybody wants to ring me, they can do so. I can give you my phone number, which is 01508 480 528.
Okay, and what about a website? Do you have one of those?
Well, I'm on the forum for the LCA, but I haven't got a website at the moment. I did have one, but it's the server's changed. But I would say also that on Saturday, the second, there are several cities in Britain where there are going to be cannabis marches. These include London, where it's in Hyde Park. There's one in Manchester, I think it's at the university. There's one in Brighton. There's one in Weymouth. And there's one in Nottingham. So the best thing to do is, if you've got any friends on Facebook, is to look up the names. If you put Frank Don't Know Jack into Facebook, you'll find a list of these marches.
Can you just remind us of your legal number again as well? Your phone number, Steve?
01508 480 528.
Well, is there any more marches or anything like that coming up? Some sort of any events from the Legalised Cannabis Alliance?
Well, there are these ones that I've just mentioned. There's one in London in Hyde Park on the 2nd of May. I've got a list of some of these. Wait a minute, I'll see if I can get these things up. There's one in Manchester. Best thing is to contact the university, mostly there to do with the university. The one in Weymouth is under the Jubilee clock at 12 to 5. Then there's one in Manchester, this is 12 at the Piccadilly Gardens. There's one in Nottingham, probably near the statue of Robin Hood.
But you haven't got one in Bristol?
And there is one in Bristol.
Aha.
Yeah, I think you need. I haven't got the details here.
Okay, so which is the website where we can find details of
it's
that?
It's in the near the university.
Where can we find it on
Cardiff.
The? Where can we find it on the internet, Steve?
Well, I've got a list here. I'll see if I'll get them put up on the LCA. On the LCA website in the next day or so.
And if not,
LCA-UK.org is our website.
And if not, people can always contact you on 01508 480 526.
528.
528, yeah. Sorry. That was Steve Barker, who's on the management committee of the Legalised Cannabis Alliance, which campaigns for the decriminalisation of drugs. So, thanks very much for joining us, Steve, on the
line. I think
it's
decriminalisation of cannabis, Tony.
Okay, not of all drugs, but, I mean, this is one of the reasons I brought this up, Martin, is because I haven't heard anything about, even though sort of in between elections, there's a lot of talk about this, very little in this general election campaign about the potential benefits or otherwise of decriminalisation.
Well, things are moving ahead in Latin America. In Latin America, all senior politicians are getting together and saying, look, we're going to have to legalise most of the drugs that we produce.
What's the difference between legalising and decriminalising then?
Well, decriminalising means tolerating something. Legalising means allowing people to just produce it and sell it in an open way. I'm actually not in favour of completely. I don't believe in free markets in drugs or anything else, but I think you've got to actually find a way to provide people who want to take drugs with safe drugs to take and cut the criminals out of the loop. That's the key, and I think the blockage there is not that is actually within the state system and within the financial system. We've become dependent on the money that hard drugs provide. Our banks are dependent on it. I mean, if we were serious about getting rid of drugs, we would basically arrest most of the people running the banks and say you're washing all this dirty money. But we don't do that because that would collapse the banks, and then we would all be starving. Well, so we're in a bit of a mess.
Maybe we'd get honest bankers if the dishonest ones were arrested.
Well, I don't. The question is, are there any honest ones? That's the problem.
Now, credit crunch beating Billy Quain joins us now with his taste of what's on for not too much money over the weekend and the next few days. So, over to you, Billy.
Welcome back. Tony has stepped out of the studio to gather his breath. My name is Billy Quain, and for the next five or so minutes, I'm going to be taking you through things to do for not very much money in Bristol for the week ahead. Let's start off at the Create Centre on Smeaton Road tomorrow at 2 p.m. for free. You can go and meet children's author Philippa Drakeford. Help Philippa illustrate characters for one of her stories and listen to The Doorway Through the Oak and other tales. It's for ages 8 to 12, Thursday 29th of April until Monday 3rd of May. The Arnoldsvale Cemetery on Bath Road is having opening celebrations. It's a weekend of all ages fun to celebrate the official reopening of the restored historic site. Watch the official opening ceremony on Thursday at 11:15 a.m. near the chapel. Explore the restored buildings, interactive exhibitions, outdoor signs and sculptures, self-guided trails, etc. You can do all of that at your leisure on Friday from 10 a.m. till 4 and continuing on from there. There is no parking on site. On Saturday afternoon, Bristol Radical History Walk is starting at 2 p.m. Donations only for this one, and it starts at the Central Ferry Landing, which are the Cascade Steps. You will pick up an awful lot more about Bristol history than you will ever get from a book on one of those walks. I can't recommend it strongly enough. And with the beautiful weather we're having recently, the Big Spring Ride starts on Queen Square, Bristol at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning. It is free, but registration is essential. For further information, telephone 01934 838 624 or bristolcyclingcampaign.org.uk. Similarly, on Saturday, you meet at the Beetle Sculpture outside at Bristol at 2 p.m. and you can go on a pirate walk, slap on an eye patch and join the historic fun. That sounds like a laugh. And on Sunday, the Clifton Rocks Railway are having their open day. It's free and it's on from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. There is a film night in the Pierian Centre on Sunday evening. It's on Portland Square in St. Paul's. It will cost you £5. For further information, it's info@pieriancentre.com, and it is a chance to see the provocative film Burma Video Journalist, or Burma VJ. It was shot by two Tibetan monks. Well worth a watch. On Sunday the 25th, Goldney Hall in Lower Clifton Hill in Bristol are having their open day. The gardens are absolutely stupendous up there. It's from midday until 5 p.m. It will cost you £3 or £1.50 if you're on a concessionary rate. There is a great exhibition at the moment until the 18th of May at the Lime Tree Gallery in Bristol. It's called Highlands and Islands. It's exuberant, colourful, thickly daubed landscapes from the Scottish Highlands and Islands by artists including David Smith, Charles Anderson and Marion Thompson. The Spike Island Open Studios run from Saturday the 1st until Monday the 3rd of May, from 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. The launch event is on Friday the 30th, and it's from 6 till 9 p.m. Theatre now. The Alma Tavern starts its month-long hosting of the new graduating class from the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School Director's Course. This time it's The Shape of Things by Neil LaBute. It will cost you £7. There is a matinee on Saturday, and it's directed by Matthew Lloyd Williams. The Bristol Hippodrome is currently playing host to the Welsh National Opera. It's not cheap. It goes from £7.50 for concessions all the way to £39.50 for full price tickets. They are covering Tosca and Carmen, everybody's favourite opera. It's followed next week by Willie Russell's Blood Brothers. At the Bristol Old Vic Theatre Royal, you are just in time to catch the very end of Juliet and Her Romeo. There is a matinee tomorrow at 2:30, and there is an evening performance at 7:30. If you haven't had quite enough Shakespeare, then get yourselves along to the Redgrave this week. Measure for Measure. It runs from 28th of April until Saturday 1st of May. It's the UWE drama production of Shakespeare's Morality Tale, directed by John Reed. It will cost you £8 full price or £6 concessions. The Tempest continues its run at the Tobacco Factory, as performed by the Shakespeare at the Tobacco Factory Company. There is a lunchtime talk tomorrow, facilitated by Andrew Hilton. It will cost you £12. You can talk to the director, Andrew Hilton, and he's joined by the cast members of The Tempest to discuss their approach to the play. Running until Sunday the 2nd of May at 8:15 p.m. in the Brewery Theatre, which is the Tobacco Factory sister theatre, costing £9 and concessionary rate of £7, anything but love. Most importantly, however, Westbury on Trim from 10 a.m. tomorrow morning is playing host to Trading Local, as performed by the professionals of the Shoals Strength Theatre Company. It's a new initiative with writing by locals for locals, performed in the shops of Westbury on Trim, and it's free. Go and see it. Tonight at the Folk House, you can go and see The Wraiths and Jess Bryant. It's going to cost you £6. Tomorrow night at the Folk House, Sarah Klass and Phil King are packing the place out. Again, £6, doors at 8 p.m. The UWE Singers and Symphony Orchestra are performing at the Colston Hall tomorrow evening at 7:30 p.m. It's £15 or £10 for a concessionary rate. Under 12s are £1. They're performing Walton's Belshazzar's Feast. The conductor is Ian Holmes, and Andrew Greenan takes the baritone solos. Raising the Curtain is the premiere of The Fanfare for 40 Brass by Adrian Hull, followed by Sibelius's Finlandia and the Brook Violin Concerto. The latter is conducted by Roger Huckle and performed by his son Emil Huckle Cleave. There is a mock election bonfire night on Sunday. It's at the Boiling Wells Project in St. Werburgh's City Farm. It's by donation only. My favourite gig of the week is on Wednesday at the Scout Hut on Redcliffe Backs. It's across the water from the Thekla. It's on at 8 p.m. It will cost you £4, and you can go and see Kid Carpet and Electric Alice. The Bristol University lunchtime concert next Wednesday is Florian Kitt on cello and Rita Mejimore on the piano. There's a retiring collection. It is on at 1:15 p.m. in the programme marking Schumann Year with the March and Builder. The duo also includes Anthony Payne's Out at the Depths Comes Song, a piece premiered in 2008, Liszt's La Lauberge Gondola and Stravinsky's Suite Italienne. Salsa Celtica are playing at the Tunnels next Thursday night. It's going to cost you £12.50 advance. They're a lively big band that brings proper Cuban salsa percussion and rhythm approach to Celtic tunes from Scotland and Ireland, adding a touch of jazz in the instrumental breaks. It's highly danceable. And finally, Ash are playing in the Academy next Friday night. It will cost you £15 advance. Go and see them. They're great.
Thanks, Billy. And that was Billy Quain with his top tips for non-TV entertainment to get you out and about over the next few days. And you can hear his arts show tomorrow morning here on BCFM 93.2 between 10 a.m. and 12 noon. Now, Martin, you've got one of your own what's on this week, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, tomorrow...
It's probably political.
It's a political thing. Tomorrow there is going to be a march in defence of adult community education in Bristol, particularly in relation to learning English as a foreign language, so of great importance to the ethnic minority communities of Bristol. The council have decided they're going to cut back a lot of the provision that's traditionally been there, presumably for budgetary reasons. But there's actually a protest march about this tomorrow, assembling right here at the Beacon Centre, where we are in the City Academy, and marching into the centre of town to protest against these cuts in adult learning. And of course, one of the paradoxes of an economic crisis is just as people lose their jobs
and need to retrain or need to keep their minds active. This is precisely the moment when we say we've got to cut back all of these kind of provision. As I've said before on this programme, that's the wrong way to think about it. We need to decide the things we want and then make sure we have them, rather than say we can't afford this and we can't afford that.
Thanks, Martin. Now, 10 years ago, a book came out which shook America and thousands of people around the world who could hardly stomach to read it. It was an autobiography and harrowing tale of an American woman, Kathy O'Brien. She says she had been systematically abused by her parents from a very young age and eventually sold by her father in exchange for his silence into an abusive psychological trauma program to take away her free will. She says she then found herself accompanying her various owners, as she describes them, on the country music scene, and she was also an escort slave for a senator, accompanying him to high-powered government events. At the age of 30, she says, she was considered too old and could be killed to keep her silent, but she was rescued and taken to a hideout in Alaska by Mark Phillips, who also helped her through what she calls deprogramming, a psychological technique which, over many months, helped her regain her sanity and her free will.
I feel very fortunate to have recovered from my mind control victimization and to have a clear view of what's actually going on behind the scenes of what Adolf Hitler and George Bush termed a New World Order.
Well, her book was called The Transformation of America and makes for shocking reading, mostly because Kathy names places and events which are verifiable. She says that one of her most powerful masters was elected politician Senator Byrd.
Senator Byrd had been in office as I've been alive. He's still in office today. He's been head of our Senate Appropriations Committee, which means he held the purse strings of our country. He decided where money would be spent. And I know from having witnessed and experienced and saw so much behind the scenes that Senator Byrd was appropriating money in directions that would allow for New World Order controls. Not only that, but my father, for having sold me into this project, was granted a lucrative military contract for making camshafts for military automobiles and all. My father became extremely wealthy on his sixth grade education.
Now, her abusers, Kathy says, used trauma techniques such as gory rituals involving animal and even human sacrifice to traumatise her, at which point she would be hypnotised and mind-programmed to obey commands. One of the techniques, she says, was abused at the time was something called neuro-linguistic programming.
It's absolutely horrific. This blood ritual was so horrible that my mind readily accepted the mind manipulation that I endured afterwards, a hypnotic language, the neuro-linguistic programming, mind control programming, that actually changed the way that my brain was functioning so that, you know, that part of my brain that I said would open up to deal with my father's abuse again and again? They changed that so that they decided when, where, and how that particular compartment of my brain would be opened and accessed. And they replaced the triggering mechanism with hypnotic codes, keys, and triggers, hand signals. There's also phone tones that can also open those neuron pathways and give access to the compartmentalized memory as well.
Now, neuro-linguistic programming is a controversial technique of often non-verbal communication or body language to persuade people, and it's often used in public relations and marketing to convince viewers or listeners that the speaker is being honest and genuine. As ex-naval officer Brian Gerrish has discovered, these NLP techniques are also being used as part of so-called leadership courses run by secretive charity Common Purpose on our police and other public servants. And it may be that if you don't do the course, you won't get promoted.
Right, I can also prove that Common Purpose is affecting important people. Peter Wilson was the chair of the advisory board for one of the local Common Purpose groups. Very important, because these select people, are you the right people to come and join Common Purpose? You don't walk in and say, I'd like to pay $5,000 and do the course. They select you, and they select you by getting you to fill in a little pro forma which gives information about your personality, where you work, what your goals and ambitions are, what you like, what you don't like. Personal psychological profiling. So you don't just join. People like this man would choose you. What business has a chief constable got to select people to join any organisation? I think he's acting outside his authority. I've used that phrase because common purpose encourages people to act outside authority. Do they use neuro-linguistic programming? Yes, they do, because this is a group, and if you can read it, they're operating across England, Wales and Scotland. They're into neuro-linguistic programming, and they're working with common purpose. Have you heard about the policeman who didn't want to get on his bike for a photograph because he hadn't done the bike safety course? But it's not funny, because that man believes what he says, and that's because somebody's played around with his mind. We've got police talking to us now after these sorts of talks, where they will tell you they keep trying to get me to go on one of these courses, but I don't want to go, because they are waking up. Religious cults, if I said, come with me, we're going to have a session with the Moonies, you would know there's a problem coming. Cult techniques can be political as well as religious, and they're very dangerous.
That was ex-naval officer Brian Gerrish, who runs a newspaper down in Plymouth called the UK Column. Now, Martin, you wanted to comment on this and the possible links to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to comment exactly on the allegations made in both of those clips, but we do know that the state has been working for many years on trying to control people's minds. It's not even a secret. After the Korean War, the U.S. prisoners were supposedly brainwashed by the North Koreans, and this created a huge panic in the U.S. So they put a lot of effort into exploring the possibility of molding people's minds. And of course, at Fort Benning in Georgia, we're talking about using torture and so on. It's a school of torture. But one of the things they used to do is these Latin American officers would have to bite the head off a live chicken on day one just to get them blooded. And these evil techniques are very much part of the war on terror, and we are actually sliding into a barbaric age because we're allowing all of this to happen with our eyes closed.
Thanks, Martin. Well, now back to Cathy O'Brien's talk, and here she describes how far advanced those mind control techniques have been developed in the United States, and all in the highest secrecy.
Mind control has advanced to the point where they know the ins and outs of the brain and the mind so well that they know how to program not only the subconscious, but to go into the primitive mind, the very area of our mind where blinking, breathing, and circulatory, heartbeat, all that is regulated. And they could go in there and put death programs in place. In my daughter's case, it was respiratory failure, so that in the event that she ever had cause to remember, which they never expected could happen, but in espionage, that can happen. We've heard of that, where the brainwashed and where they have the memory accessed. So they wouldn't have to take the old cyanide pill anymore like they used to, like spies used to. Instead, they would just simply go into respiratory failure, circulatory failure, and no information would be released at all. There was no chance of the information getting out that way.
So, well, whether or not Cathy is deluded, she certainly sounds like she did get to know some very senior people in the US government, and comments that out of the public eye, they were all part of the same political grouping.
Lampy, Missouri was a place where I heard George Bush and Bill Clinton talking. From the point of view I had, they certainly were friends, and they didn't recognize any party lines between them. That's something for the, a smoke and mirrors illusion for the public. It's not something they adhere to, because they had exactly the same agenda, and that was for bringing in this new world order. I heard George Bush talking at that time. He was talking to Bill Clinton, and I've since photographically recorded it and wrote it verbatim in our book. That when the American people became disillusioned with Republicans leading them into the New World Order, that Bill Clinton, as a Democrat, was going to be put into the office of president. This was decided in 1984. Actually, I'd heard about it even prior to that. But that, as of 1984, they were already discussing it as an absolute fact. It was also discussed in the groundwork for NAFTA.
that by the time George Bush went into the office of president, that Salinas was going to become president of Mexico, and they together would be bringing in the NAFTA, which was the beginning of New World Order controls. I was forced to participate in the criminal groundwork for NAFTA, the opening of the Juarez-Mexican border to the free trade of drugs, free trade of our nation's children. It's absolutely appalling, the criminal roots of NAFTA. Again, this is detailed in the book. But it's interesting to note that these political moves had already been decided way back when. And as I deprogrammed, and as I was, oh, it was really something to me to find out people didn't know about this stuff. I mean, it was so obvious to me. I didn't realize that people were unaware and had bought into some kind of smoke and mirrors illusions of what was going on and never thought to look behind the scenes to what was really going on. But I understand good people don't think that way. They don't have criminal minds. They don't think to look for that kind of criminal activity. Just like these guys are limited in their thinking by immorality, good people are kind of blinded from that kind of criminal activity until their eyes are open to truth. This criminal activity that was going on at that time, the people that were involved were following directions from George Bush. I don't purport to know it all. I don't purport to know that George Bush is at the very top of all this, but he is as high up as I knew. It was my experience that Ronald Reagan answered to George Bush, not robotically, not under mind control, but willingly, because George Bush was respected for what he knew about bringing in the New World Order. Consider his past. George Bush first began with the United Nations. Then he went on to head our CIA. Then he ran our country through three administrations that I'm aware of, the Reagan administration, his administration, and the Clinton administration, because Reagan and Clinton both answered to him. Mexican President De La Madrid answered to him and knew that Salinas was to be coming into power, and Salinas had more influence in Mexico at that time than De La Madrid, that, as far as my experience was concerned. Also, Saudi Arabian King Fahd followed orders from George Bush, as did the Prime Minister of Canada, Brian Mulroney. In 1983, I heard Ronald Reagan and Brian Mulroney discussing the New World Order. Senator Burt had acted in the capacity of a pimp and prostituted me to Reagan, and I was present at this White House cocktail party. Now, Ronald Reagan certainly provided a wonderful smoke and mirrors illusion for all of us. For those of you who don't want to believe that he's involved in this, he told you he's an actor. And he did a real good job of it for a long time. That was his role. That's what he was supposed to do. Nevertheless, I heard Ronald Reagan telling Brian Mulroney that he believed the only way to world peace was through mind control of the masses. I know from experience there's no peace of mind under mind control. And I wonder, at a world peace where people don't have peace of mind. Mind control, the ramifications of mind control are far-reaching, because I also know that under mind control there's no free thought. Without free thought, there's no free will.
That's the disturbing voice and the disturbing story of Kathy O'Brien there, and her book is called The Transformation, T-R-A-N-C-E, Transformation of America. Now, Martin, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'd just like to point out to our listeners, if they're interested in following up the background to these kind of allegations, they should just do a search on their computers for two things. One is Iran-Contra, and the other is MENA Air Base, M-E-N-A, MENA Air Base. MENA Air Base was being used during the 1980s when Clinton was governor of Arkansas to bring massive amounts of cocaine into the United States of America to fund the Contra War in Nicaragua. This was all being done by the Reagan administration. The people at the top in the United States of America are criminals. They've all got Interpol files.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, Sky News at 7. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week on BCFM 93.2. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour, Green Party candidate for the Southville ward in the local elections, Tess Green, and Conservative Barbara Lewis. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.